With the arrival of spring comes the glorious sunshine, but unfortunately, seasonal allergies such as hay fever, the norovirus, and colds can also appear. And as we are still very much in a pandemic, it can be difficult to know whether these are symptoms due to a seasonal bug or COVID. Mandatory PCR tests, which are the gold standard when it comes to testing, ended in January this year, meaning that many would not have received confirmation of an early COVID infection. And provision of free lateral flow tests, which can be less accurate than PCRs, is set to end on the 1st of April 2022. As COVID cases surge, especially for those over 70, it is vital to know what is causing your symptoms. Over the past 2 weeks, COVID cases have shot up by more than 25%, and according to the UK Health Security Agency, the UK HSA, 1 in 24 people in the UK currently have symptomatic COVID. In addition to this, the R value is estimated to be around 1.2, and is predicted to rise more in the coming weeks. So, if you suspect you've caught COVID, you'll need to get a private test. Dr. Walter Abelman from JDoc365, a private clinic based in London, is here to advise how best to look after yourself this spring and to know your status. One of Dr. Abelman's key pieces of advice is to focus on the length of time it takes for your symptoms to develop, and also on your body's responses to treatment to help determine if you have COVID. Traditional symptoms of COVID include a high temperature, a new continuous cough, and a loss or change to your sense of smell or taste. However, Omicron BA1 and Omicron BA2 symptoms for most people are milder and very similar to the common cold. They include fatigue, body aches, headaches, sneezing, a sore throat, a mild cough, and nasal congestion. Whilst the symptoms can be relatively mild, transmitting COVID has a greater impact on the wider community. By testing and practicing self-isolation when necessary, fewer people will be infected. It will also, hopefully, reduce the number of people suffering long-term complications from COVID. Fewer cases also means less pressure on the NHS, as hospitals are seeing a steady rise in patients with COVID. Thankfully, however, COVID death rates remain relatively low, but we cannot be complacent, as new variants could emerge from countries that have low vaccine take-up. Such countries could act as a petri dish for new variants, which could be stronger than Omicron. So, whilst isolation after COVID infection is no longer mandatory, and the root cause of your sniffles might just be hay fever, it is always better to know your status. Dr. Abelman joins us in the studio today to discuss staying well this spring. Anyway, Dr. Abelman, thanks so much for joining us today. What does the removal of restrictions mean for people across the UK?
I think besides the obvious benefit for everyday living, schooling, and the normal working of society at large, it also means that we are empowering the individual to make the right choices. One of the great things about the UK is that people generally have a very good sense of what is right and wrong. The saying, "it is just not cricket," means that within the culture of the country and the national conscience is the notion that if one is not well and one suspects one may be infectious, we do the right thing. Not because we have to, but because we want to.
Good point. And why should people keep testing regularly for COVID?
Medical journals have not stepped away from the notion that we are still in a public health emergency situation. And certainly this message is very much what the scientists at SAGE and UK HSA are reporting and saying. Testing is our way of protecting those we love and showing respect for the society we live in. We need to test so we keep others safe. And while our ITUs are 10% full compared to what they were previously during the peak of the COVID crisis, the elderly and those with weakened immune systems are still vulnerable. This extends as well to the unvaccinated, who for their own personal reasons are also vulnerable to severe infection. This still needs to be respected under a righteous monarchy.
Great stuff. And just picking up on a phrase you used there, would you say that patient empowerment is becoming something of a trend in British healthcare?
Certainly. There is a strong notion within the country that patients need to assume responsibility for their care. The nature of the provision of care in this country is such that people are needing to engage with a number of different types of practitioners to stay well. And this means understanding your health needs as a personal need and becoming almost your own expert in yourself. This does not mean that you don't have to get advice and get help from your GP or your pharmacist or any other medical profession that you wish to engage with. But it does mean that we have to assume responsibility for our health. And this extends into the COVID crisis and is very well brought out through the current trend of government thinking.
And would you say patients are gravitating more towards private healthcare as a result of patient empowerment?
I think people realize that not every condition and not every situation can be cared for in one under one umbrella group. And I think it's always about taking the best from every situation that you have. We in JDoc 365 make it very clear that we are good at, we believe people should help, we should be able to help people with. And what we're not as good at, we will always steer them towards the right direction. There are gold standards in every organization. And I think it is about the idea that there's no absolutes in anything in this world. And anyone who thinks that there is an absolute will probably find that they're absolutely wrong eventually.
And what advice would you give to people who are considering mixing with elderly relatives over the next few weeks?
With Easter, Passover, and Ramadan holidays coming up, we need to remember that we have a responsibility to keep our relatives and elderly safe. The oldest saying I know states, "Don't do to others what is hateful to you." How much better can it be expressed than this?
And what sort of non-COVID-related trends have you guys seen and been treating over the last couple of years?
JDoc 365 has been going for over 12 years, and we have built up a very large patient following in the Northwest London area. We are seeing an increasing number of cases of patients who have not been either diagnosed or have failed to attend for early diagnosis in many areas of general medicine, including cardiac disease, asthma, diabetes, and cancer. There's also an increasing number of elderly patients with complex care needs that have not been met. And we're seeing that as well and trying to correct the backlog on reversing some of the problems that have happened over the last 2 years.
And what's it been like delivering healthcare pretty much on the front line for the last couple of years?
I think it's been quite difficult for a number of reasons. I myself became very ill with COVID and was in hospital for 10 days and spent... as I like to joke, I needed the break. But when I came out, it was a different world. The whole country had gone into lockdown, and we saw a whole difference in the way we delivered care. Interestingly enough, we adopted an ability to continue seeing patients by seeing them outside. We found a venue that allowed us to be able to see people outside, and we went through a very glorious summer in 2018, which actually facilitated that fairly well. So wearing full PPE and attending to our patients in an outside area, we were able to continue to deliver face-to-face care and then continue that into the testing market as well. I think the point is that we've been able to adjust and change with the times and remain safe and protect our patients and ourselves right through the process. And that's what's been the key element here.
Would you say that certain healthcare practices have been streamlined as a result of the pandemic?
I think we've all learned to be able to triage better and manage things over the phone in a way that we hadn't done before. We had this sort of default mode where we felt that if we couldn't solve if we didn't see somebody, we're not able to actually help them efficiently. And I think that this has really changed the complexity of care and the way we deliver care. I think it's giving rise now to a whole new e-commerce type activity around medicine. And I think we will be seeing a lot more non-face-to-face, should I put it, consultations happening. And interestingly enough, this is more often generated through patient direction rather than GPs. I think people fighting traffic, fighting battles to get parking, to go to see their doctor, would much rather be able to talk to their doctor and try and solve the problem without coming in.
I understand there's also been something of a backlog in oncology appointments. So has that impacted on the work that you do?
Yeah. So the presentation or the late presentation of cancers is obviously very upsetting. It doesn't always follow that if you present late that you change your outcome or your or that the situation may be different, but very often it is a matter of upstaging or downstaging a disease process. I think people who come to us and present late with cancers, if they have the means to take this further through the private sector, will be able to be seen very fast. And I've even had cases where they've come in the morning and already been on the operating table the next morning because we've managed to do the full workup of all the tests and investigations required and see the doctor and get a diagnosis. So it's been a pretty awesome ability to see how fast things can be done. But it doesn't mean that one is disadvantaged by going through the NHS. The two-week rule applies and the four-week rule to start or to be assessed and have treatment started means that the majority of people are getting exactly the same standard of care. It's just the rate, the speed at which people want it and where they want to have their care is what determines the journey, not necessarily the outcome.
I understand there's been a not insignificant rise in diabetes rates as well over the last couple of years. What do you think some of the factors are that have contributed to this?
Diabetes is complex in that it is a multi-system disease and it is often a silent disease. By diabetes, we're actually talking about what we call type 2 or maturity onset diabetes, which paradoxically is occurring more in the young as well, as because of obesity and sedentary lifestyles, which leads really to the reality of what COVID was. It was a sedentary existence within four walls for the majority of people. And even though the Prime Minister did encourage a daily exercise, which was exceptionally important for people, I think people really were frightened into actually staying at home in case they caught something. On the other hand, nobody was testing because people weren't going to have their annual tests to check their sugars. And this meant that there was a rise in the number of patients who were slipping through the net. So 2 years down the line, we have people presenting with very raised sugars, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, increased weight, metabolically disastrous in terms of their cardiac risk factors. And some are even presenting in intensive care units with stroke and heart attacks.
And what are some of the treatment options for diabetic patients?
It all depends on the nature of how they present and what their comorbidities are. We have to look at the family history. We have to look at their weight. We have to look at the duration. We have to look at their blood pressure, their smoking history, their cholesterol, and how high their sugars are. For everybody, the baseline needs are going to be diet and exercise as the first priority to get the weight down, to improve their glucose tolerance curve, and to start them on medication. The modern treatments of diabetes are actually extremely outstanding. Not to go too much off topic, there is a group of drugs that have just now found a lot of use. These are the GLP-1 inhibitors and the SGLP-2 inhibitors. These two groups of drugs are brand new. One of them is Ozempic, which is an injectable, which is given once a week. And this is a weight loss medication as well as diabetic control. On the NHS, it's a third line medication, but in it actually could be used first line without straying outside the guidance of its use. In America, the higher dose is used as a weight loss mechanism and is actually almost equivalent to a medical bypass in that it achieves a fantastic resolution of weight loss. Unfortunately, the weight will come back when people stop the injection. And of course, there is always the financial cost of this medication. For people presenting with type 2 diabetes, the use of the SGLP-2 inhibitors has become a fascinating insight because not only does it reduce the average sugar reading by improving the excretion of sugars through the urine, but it also reduces the incidence of major associated cardiac events, which we call MACE, by 30%, which is an unbelievable number in the world of medicine. There are very few drugs that will reduce patients' risk of heart attack and stroke by 30%. So in terms of it being probably one of the most important findings in the last 5 years, I would put the SGLP2 inhibitors as one of the most important ones. There is a view that we should actually be starting with these drugs because they will reduce the incidence of what we call microalbuminuria, which is the loss of protein through the urine, which is an indirect measure of what's going on in all the vessels, including the heart, the brain, the eyes, and the feet, and the peripheral vasculature. And therefore, we are wanting to reduce this risk and mitigate people having the amount of time that they have in the diabetic state. There's also a big, strong, there's a large movement now towards reducing reliance on what we call the HbA1c, which is the glycosylated hemoglobin reading. This has been the gold standard, but is really a better tool used for population statistical analysis rather than for individual monitoring. The monitoring in an ideal world should be along the lines of what we call time in range, the TIR, which means that we should be spending between 70% of the sugar readings that we measure should be between 3.9 and 10 to be what we call time in range. And this has been shown to be the greatest benefit, preventing what we call the macrovascular, which is the heart, lungs, kidneys, and brain problems, versus the microvascular problems, which is the feet and the circulatory issues being affected. And it's a big subject. I'm very excited about it. I'm very passionate about it. We spend a lot of time working on it and educating our patients.
And I understand you do a lot around asthma too. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Asthma really, and as it revolves around cough, I think cough is probably one of the most important symptoms that people will present with, and differentiating the causes of a chronic cough are one of them, something that most GPs will find as a challenge on a daily basis. Essentially, we look at cough around four main areas. There's the psychogenic cough, which means people will cough because they're nervous or they're anxious. There's the cough that is produced through reflux. That means that people are a little bit overweight and they have acid coming up the food pipe, and that sort of overspills into the throat and can cause a cough. There's also cough which is caused through sinus illness, through upper respiratory mechanism, be it sinusitis, infections, rhinorrhea, which means that the nose is running, through allergies. And then, of course, there is the lung-related types of causes. And, of course, that includes, obviously, infection, certain cancers, as well as even asthma-type conditions. So where asthma comes into this is really as a differential of cough. One of the things that we do a lot of work in is working out the type of asthma that people have. There's several variants of asthma, which we look at in terms of four broad categories. The first is the childhood asthma, which follows a more of a linear pattern, which means that your symptoms and the severity are linked. So as the severity gets worse, the symptomatology gets worse, and the expression of the subjective and the objective measures of how you measure that are looked at. Subjective really means that what we call an asthma control test. So people will rate their degree of stability by filling in a questionnaire which looks at how often they've had time off work, how much shortness of breath, how it's affected their sleep, how they rate their own asthma, and this is given a score. That's a subjective score. Then the objective measures of asthma would be measuring something called a FeNO, which is a fractionated exhaled nitric oxide. This is a simple breath test which is done on a machine that we use, and it measures nitric oxide levels. Nitric oxide is produced in inflammatory conditions, and one of the most important inflammatory conditions is asthma. It's not obviously the only cause for nitric oxide being high, but it will be a very important condition, and it's a very good marker, not just of asthma diagnosis, but also asthma control. We use the nitric oxide level 2 as a diagnostic tool in adults, as well as to monitor them for their control. And the levels of the nitric oxide are used as on a regular basis to assess for whether we up or down medication accordingly. That's the first type of asthma. The second type is allergic asthma, which has a very high expression of symptoms, but may actually not be. Allergic type of asthma, in which there is a very high expression of objective measures such as a high FeNO, but patients generally have a low disease burden, so they don't actually feel that unwell. This is classically young men who have runny noses, may have quite a lot of hay fever during the summer, and may have a low level of cough, but classically their FeNO levels are very, very high, and they are not actually aware of how much inflammation is being produced within their respiratory mechanism. The third type is where you have a very high expression of symptoms, but very low objective measures of asthma. And we call this group the neutrophilic group. This is your reflux group. So these are people who have maybe refluxing and producing a lot of acid, and it's overspilling into the lungs and causing an inflammatory response. Your archetypal middle-aged person who's overweight and walks around with a constant cough all day long. These people are treated with combinations of antibiotics and acids, but they don't respond to steroids. Their FeNOs are classically very low. And then there's the fourth group, who are what we call the benign asthma group. These tend to be middle-aged to elderly, more elderly men in their 50s, 60s, I'm in that age group, so I can say I'm elderly already. But let's say they are presenting for the first time with cough, and when you measure their FeNOs, they're not that high, but they actually respond very well to a simple steroid inhaler, and it deals with their asthma. So they're in broad spectrum of different types of asthma. And of course, the use of FeNO is extremely important in differentiating this group. And of course, asthma is a subgroup of patients who have cough. So I hope that answers some of the questions.
Hugely comprehensive, absolutely fantastic, and perfect timing as well.
And where can listeners go for more information?
So JDoc365 offers a range of testing options, and if you're concerned that you may be symptomatic, we can help you by arranging a postal test or in-house test at our testing center in NW11. You can also go online to request a test to be posted to your home. We have an excellent website with clear information, and we send tests throughout the country. We also have excellent customer relations teams to assist you by phone or email. I would make the point that testing is important, but sometimes the science fails, and therefore, practically speaking, if one has a lateral flow test kit at home and this is positive, you don't need to waste money on a PCR test. Similarly, if you are obviously unwell with symptoms that are classic COVID in nature, such as loss of taste and smell, you may not need a test to confirm that you have COVID-19, and you should take reasonable and sensible precautions to look after oneself and those around you as well. For those who are interested, please go to our website, jdoc365.co.uk, where you will find that we are able to assist you either online or in person.